Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello, welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you from the BBC World Service studios in London with me, Tim Franks, and we'll also, later in the programme, hear from my colleague James Menendez in San Antonio, Texas. We're going to begin with one of the UN Secretary General's favourite alarmist metaphors. We are, he said today, playing with fire. It is an apt image, given that he was talking in this case about the UN Environment Agency's annual report into how we're all doing in the effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Its sober conclusion, catastrophic. At least if we carry on with our current efforts, which leave us en route for an increase in global temperatures, not within the target of 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, but 3.1 degrees. We'll pick apart the figures and also try to explore how and why we shouldn't be despondent. Let's begin, though, with the figures, with our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
The emissions gap report has been produced for the last 15 years or so. What it's been looking at is the amount of carbon produced in 2023 and seeing a significant increase. Now, 1.3% mightn't sound like a huge increase, but it's much bigger than the preceding decade's average annual increase. And what's driving it up in 2023 was the rebound from the COVID pandemic. More flying, more people driving, a range of industries kickstarting again. So we've had quite a surge of CO2, if you like, and the scientists behind this are saying if this continues, if we don't rein it in, we are in significant trouble and more trouble than perhaps we've thought, and temperatures will respond in the natural way and rise very quickly and very high.
As you say, 1.3% may not sound like a huge amount, but given that we're supposed to be cutting our greenhouse gas emissions, it's going to only make reaching that target all the more difficult. I mean, presumably you'll end up with even steeper cuts needing to be made.
That's exactly right. I think there's a great deal of frustration among scientists at the UN and elsewhere that since COP26 in Glasgow in 2021, while there have been great speeches and great promises of transitioning away from fossil fuels, not much action has been taking place on the ground. We're essentially still in the same territory we were back then, except we've used up three more years. And to keep these temperatures reined in, you know, the scientists are clear that 2030, we have to keep below a certain level. To get to that level, we need to cut emissions by about 42% between now and then. Dramatic and drastic cuts of which the world has never really seen the like. So they're saying that the time is getting shorter. You know, it's still technically possible. And I suppose the sad thing here is that the technical and the economic incentives have never been stronger, but the time has never been shorter. And it's that is driving, I think, a great deal of hair pulling and frustration among scientists.
I guess the other thing about, you know, talking about these figures, you know, people like you are always trying to explain that these fractions of a degree, they sound minuscule, but they actually can make immense differences to our planet.
People might logically think that if it goes from 1.3 to 1.4 degrees of warming, we'll get the same bang for buck as we did from 1.2 to 1.3. But it doesn't work that way in the real world. We get this amplifying effect so that a fraction of a degree more can do far more damage. That's why scientists are really worried about going past that 1.5 threshold. And that's why they produced a report a number of years ago to show that if you went to 2 degrees as opposed to 1.5, it would be, you know, extremely damaging for many parts of the world and many species. So that's something they want to drive home. This temperature figure of 1.5 degrees, you know, described as the North Star by Sultan Al-Jaber in Dubai last year, who led the talks, the climate talks there, being so politically important to developing countries, even if it's starting to really slip out of sight now in a scientific term, as today's report makes clear.
Our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath. So we've got a reason, many reasons, really, to be alarmed. But we shouldn't be paralysed by fear. According to Professor Johann Rockström, the director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany, the point is, he says, we know what needs to be done.
We're talking now of the need to transition from increasing global emissions by 1% per year to reducing emissions by 7.5% per year, to cut emissions by half within the next 5 years and reach a net zero world economy within the next 25 years. Now, how can you get the entire world to transition away from oil, coal, and gas at that pace? Well, we actually know how to do this. The number one is, of course, to have the science in place, the accountability, and have legally binding targets set for all countries. But we have that with the Paris Agreement. We know that emissions need to be cut by 50% by 2030. And if every country was held accountable to that, you can measure year by year, country by country, that accountability. So accountability is number one. Number two is that there's so much economic research showing, and the UNEP GAP report actually puts a number on that as well, that if we had a global price on carbon in the order of $200 per ton of carbon dioxide, that would essentially overnight do what's happened in the UK, namely transitioning away from coal. It's no longer economically viable. It would also help us to accelerate the pathway away from oil and gas. Number three is that we need to help developing countries, the rapidly emerging economies in particular, with credit finance so that they can afford to invest in renewable energy systems. And that's the topic for this year's climate negotiations, to put the trillions of US dollars on the table to help economies invest in solar and wind and biomass and hydrogen fuel cell systems, and to do that at low interest rates. And remember that we have an annual subsidy to fossil fuel sources in the order of $7 trillion per year, just in subsidies to damage the planet, and put 1/7 of that into investments into green technologies, and we would actually start moving decisively in the right direction. So we have quite a good handle on the levers that we can deploy to accelerate the pathway in this quantum leap requirement.
It sounds from what you are saying that it needs to be a combination of firm national determined contributions, as they're called. In other words, real hard targets for individual countries, plus also a global will to come together in order to make sure that we all move the same pace.
That is what we need. We need political leadership among the heads of state, in particular the big economies in the world. And that may also, of course, sound very, very challenging. And in the geopolitical situation today, it certainly is. But remember that there are four actors that largely determine whether or not we can succeed. And it's the US, it's China, it's India, and it's Europe. Here we have the four largest emitters, the four largest economic regions. If these four decide that enough is enough, we cannot risk moving towards the catastrophic warming that we're now heading towards, if these four would act together as political leaders, that would spill over on the entire global economy.
Johann Rockström from the Potsdam Institute. The Commonwealth is a rather particular global club. Its 50-plus member states account for almost a third of the world's population. A lot of them were previously part of the British Empire. And that turns out to be key to the current Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. Because in defiance of the UK's wishes, Commonwealth leaders say they intend to start a conversation about how Britain can make amends for its historic links to the transatlantic slave trade. Today, the British senior finance minister, Rachel Reeves, ruled out paying reparations. So what is wanted from those countries where the abuse happened? Frederick Mitchell is the foreign minister of the Bahamas and has been speaking to my colleague, Nuala McGovern.
There is a general approach in the communique which is asking for the beginnings of a discussion on the question of reparatory justice, which means at this juncture a discussion on what happened, why it happened, who's responsible, and how is justice going to be served today and in the future.
How would you describe the response you have got from the British government?
I think it's been respectful, but essentially it's not moved. At this point, you're just arguing about four words. The question is whether there's going to be a separate declaration on reparatory justice or whether there's going to be a line in the communique itself which simply says that there's going to be this commitment and recognition to a discussion or a need for reparatory justice. And that's where we're stuck at the moment.
I want to play a little off Lisa Nandy. This is the government's response. She's a British MP. When she was asked about this issue.
There are serious, serious challenges facing countries like the Bahamas. They're dealing with a triple crisis of climate change, historic debt on very poor terms, and growing problems of poverty. We've got to help them break out of that. And as a country that is the legal jurisdiction where many of those debts are settled and with one of the biggest insurance markets in the world, we are almost uniquely placed to help them do that. The idea that at this moment in the UK's history, with the challenges facing other countries around the world and the world collectively, that we would be focused on anything other than dealing with the challenges that we have now and how we future-proof the world against climate change would be the wrong approach.
So, Minister, that does not sound like she, as representing the government, is coming to that issue with the same mindset that you are. What would your response, first off, be to her?
Respectfully, there's no difference between the solutions that she's proffering and what we're suggesting needs to be adopted and considered. The future for the Caribbean has been and is influenced by the past. But let's take one example. The British were in charge of Jamaica, and there was underdevelopment during that period of time. So you had to spend money on education. Education costs money. Education is the future. And so if, with respect, the member of parliament is talking about the future, you agree then that there needs to be investment in the future.
But, you know, there was one estimate, which could be £18 trillion that the UK would possibly pay in reparations for its role in slavery in 14 Caribbean countries. Now, you know, that would be something very difficult for the government to be able to swallow, to be able to also sell to the people. How would you sell it to the public if you were Sir Keir Starmer?
I say that's a scare tactic. I think it doesn't start there. The first thing is whether or not there's an acceptance of the responsibility, and second, whether there needs to be an apology saying, I'm sorry, and then you start framing how you deal with the question of reparations. This begins as a conversation, and then it evolves into something which settles the matter. The conversation is the beginning of the process, because people have to come around to something which may seem too far-fetched or too expensive, but the moral conscience always goes in the right direction. If you're responsible, if there's loss and damage, as we are discussing in the climate change factor, there has to be an agreement as to how it is repaired.
And if there is no movement on the issue?
The whole question of abolition started with no, but the moral argument began and people kept at it and kept at it, and eventually the whole thing was resolved. Now, the irony was that when they abolished slavery, the slave owners were paid. I think it was 40% of your budget when it was actually done. And in 2015, the notes were paid off. So the long arc of history always goes in the right direction. And I believe at the end, people will come around to it.
In your time?
If not in my lifetime, certainly in the lifetime of the juniors who are around me now, they know that the fight must continue.
Frederick Mitchell, Foreign Minister of the Bahamas, speaking to Nuala McGovern. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming up on the programme, we'll have a new insight into the Israeli airstrike on a school in northern Gaza earlier this week.
3 days ago, a drone descended on the school at 9 in the morning, giving us an ultimatum that we needed to leave before 10. The drone loudspeaker said we had to evacuate the school because we were in a dangerous fighting zone. We didn't have time to pack our stuff. It gave us just an hour. After just 10 minutes, Israeli airplanes bombed the school.
More on that investigation carried out by our international editor, Jeremy Byrne, in about 15 minutes. Our main headline this hour, the UN says the world is on track to miss global warming limits by a catastrophic margin without a huge push to cut carbon emissions.
You're listening to NewsHour with Tim Franks in London and me, James Menendez, in San Antonio, Texas. And we're here because this is a part of the United States, well, it's really at the sharp end of the debate over immigration during the campaign. One of the main concerns for voters going into the presidential election, now just 12 days away. From here, it's just a couple of hours' drive to the Mexican border, and you feel the influence everywhere. Spanish is widely spoken here, and nearly two-thirds of the population identify as Hispanic. But it's the issue of illegal immigration that's come to dominate the campaign, a deliberate strategy, it seems, by Donald Trump and the Republicans, who've used slurs and false stories about migrants, eating pets, for example, to make it one of the top concerns for their supporters, and many Democrats too. And if the polls are right, it is an issue that favours Mr. Trump. His Democratic opponent, Kamala Harris, has had to tack right to keep up, promising, for example, to further tighten security along the border. Well, we've spent the past week or so looking at the issue from both sides of that border. We began our journey in the city of Monterrey, in the state of Nuevo León, in northern Mexico. At the Monarch Refuge, named after the famous migrating butterfly, a group of small children play in the gravel of the courtyard. Around them, a series of basic but clean dormitories housing about 100 people, drawn from all over Central and South America. What they have in common is that all of them want to get to the United States. For José Luis and Rosa Mariño, this is the first time for 6 months they and their three children have felt safe. They say they left Venezuela because of political repression and the dire state of the economy there, embarking on the long and often perilous journey towards the US-Mexico border.
We thought that the jungle was the hardest part, but when we got to Mexico, we saw it was even worse, because if you are not running from the immigration police, you are paying the cartels to let you continue your journey north. Otherwise, they'll kidnap you or hurt you. What happened to us was that a guy told us he'd give us a lift. He said he'd take us in his car, but before we knew it, we were being held hostage at a farm. Then you have to pay. Otherwise, they won't let you go.
There are plenty of smugglers who take them across, but for them, it's a risk too far. Instead, they want to apply for asylum in the US. And finally, last week, they were given a date for their interview with the immigration authorities. It's in 2 weeks, but not at the border crossing near here. Instead, it's in Tijuana, across from San Diego, 3 hours away by plane. Another journey and another expense. But Rosa says it's worth it.
I know we're going to have to work hard, but at least there'll be opportunities, and it's a safe country where my children will be able to get a good education. We just hope for a peaceful life, nothing amazing, just somewhere we can work. And ultimately, we're doing it for them, the children and their future.
Others, though, are stuck in limbo. Sonia's from Honduras. She has two grown-up sons already in the US and two other younger children with her in Mexico. She's been waiting 10 months for her asylum interview. She tells me she doesn't want to wait any longer, even if that means crossing the border illegally. And this is the border that so many want to cross. I'm now on the US side in a city called Laredo, looking back into Mexico across the Rio Grande. But it's not very big at this point, maybe 40 or 50 metres across and fairly shallow by the looks of it. The birds just flitting in the reeds that line the riverbanks. The numbers trying to cross without the right papers are down in recent months, the result of a strict cap on asylum claims introduced by President Biden a few months ago. But many still do. More than 2,000 people were stopped by Border Patrol agents in August on this stretch alone. You can see their green and white trucks dotted along the riverbank. Others, though, do manage to slip through.
Okay, so we are in South Texas on my family's cattle ranch.
Stephanie Crisp Canales grew up on this farm, and now she and her husband Marcus run it. She's also head teacher at the local school. She says groups of undocumented migrants regularly trespass across their land, playing a dangerous game of cat and mouse with Border Patrol.
The majority of them come in through vehicles that they run through our fences, run through our gates, so that causes a lot of damage. We also have them that come in on foot. They leave trash behind. We run a cattle operation, so that's, you know, worrisome for our cattle. We don't want our cattle to eat the trash when it's cost us thousands of dollars.
And so what do you do when that happens?
Well, obviously, you know, we call the Border Patrol, and then we usually try to follow them. We try to stop them, because we don't want them on our property. Because a lot of them that are walking on property, they are the ones that cannot apply for asylum because they are the ones that have records from their country. So they're wanted for murder. They're wanted for rape.
And how do you know that? Do you know that for sure? I mean, they can't all be murderers, can they?
No, but, you know, because we've had several large groups here on our property that the Border Patrol have caught. And they will tell us, yeah, you know, this one's wanted for murder. We're like, oh, man, you know, I mean, that's really scary. When you live here and you see it every single day, it's not letting up. And I don't think it's going to until somebody gets in office that's going to truly, truly shut the border down.
And who is that, do you think? Is that Donald Trump?
I mean, right now, that's our only hope. So that's what we're hoping for.
For those who manage to evade the Border Patrol, there is plenty of work in Texas, much of it in construction to satisfy the growing demand for housing. Not that anyone will admit to deliberately employing undocumented workers. The state's Republican Governor Greg Abbott wants local law enforcement to have the power to arrest and deport all those who cross illegally. But there would be a price to pay. Ed Berlanger is a house builder in San Antonio. He says he tries hard to ensure everything's above board, but sometimes that's not possible.
We hire, you know, companies that employ other people. We obviously work towards making everything as legal as possible, but from a builder standpoint, you know, we're hiring a contracting company or a subcontracting company or a supplier, and they hire folks. Nobody's checking their cards or anything like that to get them to work.
But if those undocumented migrants, if they weren't there, then the houses wouldn't get built, right? Or at least not as many.
Not as many and more slowly. And time is money, so the longer things take to do, the more expensive it is.
That was Ed Berlanger, chief executive of Texas Homes here in San Antonio. And what he says has been echoed by other people we've been speaking to here. It isn't something people necessarily want to go public with, but quietly they will tell you that in sectors such as construction and also in hospitality, this is a city full of restaurants and hotels, undocumented workers are a fact of economic life. Well, we'll be talking about that and the two presidential candidates' proposals on immigration, such as they are at this point, later in the program. That is coming up in half an hour. And don't forget, as ever, there is a live page now up and running with coverage of the final days of the US presidential campaign at our website, bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Tim Burton is one of the world's most acclaimed directors. He's known for his eccentric and gothic filmmaking. Now Mr. Burton's archives of costumes, models and drawings from films and programmes like Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands and Wednesday are going on display in London. Our correspondent Charlotte Gallagher went to meet him.
I can't believe I'm doing this. Beetlejuice!
The Hollywood journey is an Alice in Wonderland kind of journey. You go up, you go down, you go sideways. That's just the way it is. But I did feel lately, doing Wednesday, going to Romania and just doing it, and then doing Beetlejuice, it kind of reconfirmed the fact that if people want me to do something, it's best to let me do what I, you know. There's often a case of, like, once you become a thing, that they want you, but then they don't want you. So what I realize now, and maybe because I'm older as well, it's like, okay, I'm just going to do what I want, and if you want to do it, fine. If not, then you don't have to go on this journey with me.
I think you're quite rare among directors and writers and creators in that you're a bit similar to Roald Dahl in that you don't patronise children, you don't patronise kids, and they're drawn to the monsters and the scary stuff.
It's exactly. I mean, I can't tell you how many films, every film I ever did. And first of all, I never said, I'm making this for children or adults. Right? So, but they go, you can't tell, it's too scary for kids. You like Nightmare. And you know what? It's the big, I've heard this every single time, and every single time it means nothing. It's funny because, like, little kids' Nightmare, little kids. I grew up watching monster movies, so I know some kids can handle it, some kids can't, and that's fine. You know, everybody's an individual. You don't have to force them Clockwork Orange style to sit there and watch a horror movie. You know, they'll either go for it or they won't go for it, like I did.
Can you be scary? What do you think of this?
When you're making one of your films or you're making a sequel to one of your films, do you just kind of have to block out what's going on the internet, what people say, and make your own film?
Yeah, anybody who knows me is I'm a bit technophobe. And so what I find is, that's why I don't go onto it much. If I look in the internet, I found really that I got quite depressed. It was interesting. It scared me because I started to go down a dark hole. I looked up things where, you know, I mean, I looked up things like buying some dinosaurs, which was good, but looking up things that I just felt like I was going down a dark path, and it didn't make me feel good. So I try to avoid it because it doesn't make me feel good.
And the monsters in your films are often the ones that people connect with the most, and they tend to be the heroes.
When I grew up on watching these movies, I mean, it was very clear, all of them, from King Kong to Frankenstein to Creature from the Black Lagoon. All the monsters were the most emotional. You know, the humans were the ones that scared me. Mm-hmm. They were the ones, the angry villagers in Frankenstein, like the internet, these nameless faces, you know. And the monster always had the most emotion. It had the most feeling, even though they're looked upon as a certain way.
And that was Tim Burton speaking to the BBC's Charlotte Gallagher. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service in London with me, Tim Franks. Towards the end of last week, I spoke to an Israeli minister, Amichai Chikli, and asked him about the situation in northern Gaza, particularly about the lack of aid getting in. It's part of northern Gaza, the minister said, where we've created a blockade with our forces. We've allowed the civilian population to escape into the safe zone, and we've prevented supplies from entering the blockaded region. One of the locations he name-checked as being part of that blockaded region from which civilians had been allowed to escape was Jabalia. That is where, on Monday, a UN school was hit in an Israeli airstrike. Israel insists it was targeting Hamas fighters as precisely and carefully as possible. Today, another school, this in central Gaza, was hit, with the local hospital saying at least 17 people had been killed. It's very difficult for us to know exactly what is going on in Gaza. Israel doesn't allow journalists, including the BBC, to enter Gaza except under trips highly supervised by the IDF. So we're left trying to piece together the evidence as we can find it. This, then, is our international editor Jeremy Bowen's follow-up report to that strike in Jabalia, northern Gaza, 3 days ago.
From the outside, it's hard to comprehend the depth of suffering experienced by civilians in Gaza. On Monday this week, a video emerged from Jabalia that gave an unusually detailed insight into the pressure and the horror imposed on civilians by Israel's current offensive in northern Gaza. Watching it, you feel almost like an eyewitness. In the video, a paramedic called Naveen al-Dawawi runs between dead and dying civilians, trying to help them as she films with her phone. When I reported this first on Monday, she was misidentified as Nabila. Close to panic herself, Naveen is telling a woman sitting in a deep pool of her own blood to stay calm. I swear, she says, I don't have anything to stop the bleeding. We managed to track down Naveen in Gaza City, much more composed now. She was able to give a freelance journalist working for the BBC her own account of what happened on Monday morning. Naveen said they'd been besieged at the Jabalia Boys Elementary School for 16 or 17 days. Then on Monday, a quadcopter, a small drone the IDF uses for surveillance and killing, flew low over their shelter.
We were living in so much fear when the school was hit. We had people killed and injured. There was nothing there to eat or drink at the refugee center in the school. The water tanks couldn't come to us because of the Israeli bombing. It was like that for days. 3 days ago, a drone descended on the school at 9 in the morning, giving us an ultimatum that we needed to leave before 10. The drone loudspeaker said we had to evacuate the school because we were in a dangerous fighting zone. We didn't have time to pack our stuff. It gave us just an hour. After just 10 minutes, Israeli airplanes bombed the school.
The video says a lot about civilians in war because it shows the first moments after an attack when individuals are struggling to understand how everything has changed in an instant. In the video, a woman's voice is heard saying, "My children are gone." Naveen says, "How do you know?" The mother says, "Look at them." Journalists working for the BBC found the woman, Lina Abu Namos, in Kamal Adwan Hospital in Jabalia with shrapnel wounds and unbearable grief.
I saw my daughter dying with my own eyes. She was dying in front of me. I couldn't stop it, and she was my eldest, my whole life. I couldn't save her, and I was also wounded. I couldn't help myself. I found myself falling on the ground.
Naveen, the paramedic, talked our reporter through the video she'd made as she played it back on her phone.
The video shows how scared we were. Our neighbor, Abu Muhammad, was killed. He was hit in the neck. His two sons were also killed. The video showed girls torn to pieces. Men were horribly killed. Some women who were taking cover were also injured, and others killed.
Israel insists its forces respect the laws of war, and it says that civilians get killed in Gaza because Hamas uses them as human shields. We put that to Naveen al-Dawawi, the paramedic. Our reporter asked whether Hamas was using civilians as human shields. No, she said. Hamas was not doing that. They were protecting us and standing with us. For many in Israel, that statement will justify the horrors that the IDF brought down on the civilians just after 9 in the morning in that school on Monday, the 21st of October. But the laws of war state that force used by an attacking army needs to be proportionate. A major Hamas presence might legally justify killing and wounding civilians, including many children. A few low-level gunmen would not. In the hospital, Lina Abu Namos was haunted by the loss of her eldest daughter, her only son, and everything they called home.
What crime have the children committed? What have they done? What have we done to deserve this? All the children, just like my daughter, they have shrapnel in their legs. My daughter has a metal plate in her leg from the thigh to the ankle. I swear they've destroyed our children.
The bereaved Lina Abu Amos, sending that report by Jeremy Bowen. And Jeremy spoke to me a little bit earlier. He's in Jerusalem. He covered that unspeakable misery in Gaza. But there does seem to be some discussion towards the end of today, anyway, about possible new ceasefire talks. What's he been hearing?
Well, yes, I think this has come out of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit to the area. He was in Israel, and then he went down to the Gulf. He spoke to the Saudis, he spoke to the Qataris, and I think he headed for London. He's pushing for that. The Americans believe that the killing by Israel of Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas, opens a window for diplomacy. I don't think many other people do believe that, least of all the Israelis. But all sides seem to be prepared to go along with it at the moment. It isn't clear what Hamas wants, what their conditions are. Are they different to the ones that Hamas under Sinwar would have gone for? And maybe that will become clearer. But you know what? I think at the moment, as far as the Israelis are concerned, they have this idea right now, especially with U.S. elections coming up any minute and a lame duck Biden presidency, that they can pretty much push as hard as they want, do what they want, escalate the way they want. And that actually is, from their point of view, bringing dividends.
And should we read then from that into what might happen in Lebanon? And I saw that the IDF chief of staff said that there could be a, as he put it, a sharp conclusion to the fighting. What did you read into that?
Well, I'm not quite sure what he meant, because a lot of people who are looking at the situation there are seeing a quagmire in the making. Every other time since it was founded as a state that Israel has invaded Lebanon in the 70s, in the 80s, a near war in the 90s when they were occupying Lebanon, the 2006 war, none of it has ended well for them, because they tend to either get bogged down, get carried away by initial victories, have mission creep, try and achieve more, trying to maybe somehow reorder the regional setup than they started off wanting to do. So I would be skeptical about easy, quick or cheap victories for Israel in Lebanon.
And that was the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen, speaking to me from Jerusalem. To Mozambique now. There wasn't much tension over the election result announced late today, or at least much surprise. The ruling party Frelimo had, as expected, was declared the winner of a landslide, with a landslide victory in a hotly disputed vote. But tension certainly has followed, with local media reporting empty streets and closed businesses. Daniel Chapo is set to be the new president after the incumbent with Frelimo reached his term limit. Mr. Chapo was announced as having won 71% of the vote against the main opposition candidate, Venancio Mondlane. José Temba is a journalist in the capital, Maputo.
Daniel Chapo is the youngest presidential candidate put forward by the ruling Frelimo party. He joined politics a bit late. He's not from the veterans of the independence war. He first acted as a district administrator in politics, then became provincial governor, and now he's going to be the president of the republic.
But clearly, a lot of people who wanted there to be change in Mozambique, because Mozambique has very many, very large problems, don't think that he's going to be a candidate for change. What are they upset about?
They are worried about particularly his ruling Frelimo party, which has a very bad history of corruption, failing to bring an end to terrorism and to kidnapping.
And am I also right in saying that there's been a considerable amount of unhappiness about the way in which this election has been held? People not convinced that it was done so in a free and fair way.
That's true. Electoral observers, the opposition, are extremely unhappy about the way the elections were conducted. They said they were rigged. There was a lot of ballot stuffing, huge abstentions, and ghost voters. But all these claims have been denied by the announced winners.
Now, there was violence in the run-up to the announcement of the result with the lawyer for the opposition, who was probably going to be the one who was going to be placing any court challenges. He was shot dead along with another senior figure in the main opposition party. Has there been more violence, or have there been clashes since then?
Not necessarily. Today there was a peaceful march because Venancio Mondlane, the independent presidential candidate who called for these demonstrations or protests, had called for them to stay away today and tomorrow in protest of the results. He also said people could march in their neighborhoods against the results, which he claims to be fraudulent. So this demonstration took place in the industrial town of Matola, a few kilometers away from the Mozambican capital, Maputo. It was a peaceful march. There were no clashes between the police and the protesters. But business was partially closed in Maputo. Many people could not turn up to work because there was shortage of transport, and the people were afraid to venture into the streets, thinking that the unrest of last Monday could occur again.
José Tembe speaking to me from Maputo, and that was a little bit earlier today or this evening local time. And since we recorded that interview, it has emerged that a number of people have been killed in protests taking place in several towns in Mozambique following the announcement of those disputed election results. You're listening to NewsHour.
You're listening to NewsHour with Tim Franks and me, James Menendez, in San Antonio in Texas, where I've been looking at one of the hottest topics in the US presidential campaign, immigration. America's southern border with Mexico is just a couple of hours' drive away. Well, it is a huge and complex subject, and I've been discussing some of the issues with two people who've both worked on immigration and border security in previous Republican and Democrat administrations. Roberta Jacobson is a former US ambassador to Mexico, who resigned during Donald Trump's first term, then going on to advise President Biden on US-Mexico border affairs. And also Laura Reese, who's director of the Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. Previously, she worked in the first Trump administration at the Department of Homeland Security. So I asked her, is Donald Trump really going to start deporting all undocumented migrants, as he said? Is it even possible?
Well, given the number of the historic number of inadmissible aliens that the Biden-Harris administration has let into the country, yes, we need to deport large numbers of people back home. That is what the American people want, and that is enforcing the laws that Congress has passed. Our communities are simply overwhelmed with too many numbers of people that they cannot support, whether it's the public schools or health care or housing or taxes, etc. This isn't what a lawful, orderly, or manageable immigration system looks like, and we need to get back to one.
Roberta Jacobson, does Kamala Harris, do you think, have a plan for dealing with those millions of undocumented migrants living in the U.S.? One estimate suggests about 11 million. At the moment, the plans seem rather vague.
Well, I think one of the things that you have to remember is that she has run a 90-day campaign, and so the ability to, in a normal presidential campaign, perhaps put out more fulsome policy papers is rather truncated. And I'm not working within her campaign, so I can't really speak to what they may be thinking within the campaign. But I think there's a couple of things that, you know, she has made clear and are important to underscore. One is, you know, she's talked about both being a country welcoming of humanitarian needs from migrants. Now, in many cases, that may be refugees, people who are, in fact, fleeing persecution as defined by treaty and our own law. But the fact of the matter is what we have at the border is not a border crisis, right? There's still more than a million travelers crossing every day, and trade, legal trade, is up across the border. What we have is an asylum crisis, because when you want to welcome people and also enforce your laws, everyone claims asylum. And, you know, legal pathways, as the vice president and presidential candidate has outlined, is not amnesty.
Okay. Laura Rees, I'm thinking about trade and the economy. I mean, what about the economic impact of a mass deportation? I mean, not only the cost of carrying it out, but, I mean, who's going to fill those jobs? Won't it just send wages spiraling and therefore inflation as well?
Well, the government is currently spending billions of dollars through multiple departments to pay NGOs and organizations to facilitate the mass immigration here. That needs to stop, and change that money over to enforcing our laws. Also, the money that American taxpayers are having to spend to support the millions who are here in violation of the law is a savings.
As we've heard, though, lots of those undocumented migrants also pay federal income taxes.
Well, the job market right now, the increase in jobs have gone to immigrant workers almost in direct juxtaposition to Americans losing out on jobs. So we need to create opportunities for Americans to get those jobs. And unfortunately, they are not being given those opportunities because too many people want to pay lower wages to non-American workers.
Roberta Jacobson, I mean, why aren't there more work permits available, though?
James, I think it's a great question, and your piece really outlined the dilemma, frankly, that employers face. Why are there not more temporary work programs is exactly the problem, right? You know, H-2A, I don't want to be too technical, but the agricultural programs, the agricultural programs don't have any caps, right? So we could welcome all the people who want to come. But it doesn't reflect the current demographics of migrants, right? They're not all from Mexico, and that's where that program has been extensive. But more importantly, the kinds of jobs that we're talking about, which are low-skilled jobs, there are caps in the number of people who can enter the United States through those programs. The fact of the matter is, the people who are coming in an undocumented manner are not taking jobs that would go to Americans. Even were wages to rise with a comprehensive immigration plan, right, you would not have Americans taking those jobs. We've seen that time and time again.
Let me put some of that to Laura. And Laura, we've heard from people here in Texas, a defiantly Republican state, who say, look, we cannot manage without, actually, if we're being honest, without some of that undocumented labor. So when Donald Trump talks about migrants destroying the fabric of the country, actually, they're doing the jobs that lots of people don't want to do, aren't they?
Well, again, it comes back to the wages. Americans are hard workers. It's untrue and insulting to say there's jobs that Americans won't do. It's about the wages and having the opportunity to apply for those jobs and be actually considered for those jobs, given the labor securities in terms of safety and wages and all that goes with it, versus giving it to someone who can be paid less and receive less safety requirements, etc., that comes with our labor laws. But also in terms of more legal programs, I mean, this administration has been giving work authorization to the asylees, to the parolees, to temporary protected status, and yet the illegal numbers still continue. So we need to enforce the law to have an operation system.
Laura Rees of the Heritage Foundation, and I was also talking to Roberta Jacobson, former U.S. ambassador to Mexico. It is an irony of history that 200 years ago, Texas was part of Mexico, and it was the Mexican army trying to expel immigrants from the United States. Battles like the Alamo, which took place just half a mile from here in San Antonio. Well, there'll be more from Mexico and Texas on tomorrow's program. We're going to be looking at the deep trade ties between this part of Texas and northern Mexico. Donald Trump has been talking about imposing a universal tariff on all imports into the US. We'll be finding out what that would mean for businesses on both sides of the border. But that is it for this edition of NewsHour today. From me in Texas and also Tim Franks in London and all the teams in both countries, thank you very much for listening. Until the next time, take care. Bye-bye.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.